Hello and welcome to Workhorse, the podcast about Royal Australian Air Force C-130 Hercules aircraft. Today we're talking about unique operations in the 1975 to 1986 era. I'm your host, Bill Kourilakis. Some of you know me as K-9. I served over 30 years in the Canadian and Australian Air Forces, primarily in air mobility roles. In this historically informative podcast series, I cover the entire history of Australian C-130s, including a look at how Australian history was shaped by Australia's Hercules aircraft. This podcast series is generally chronological, and it's based upon an extensive history book I wrote about Australian Air Force C-130s titled Air Mobility Workhorse, which should be published in late 2024. Today, I've got a smattering of unique operations to tell you about. They aren't connected by any particular theme, other than to say that they're all reflective of the flexibility inherent in the C-130 and Australia's growing dependence on the Hercules to deliver a variety of effects through that period. Let's start with some United Nations missions. Participation in UN peacekeeping was Australian government policy from the mid-1950s, and it was specifically called out in the 1976 White Paper as a way in which Australia could meaningfully contribute to the global community. After Vietnam, Australia increased its involvement in UN operations through a number of global peacekeeping operations. For example, in March 75, the small Australian commitment to the United Nations Military Observer Group in India and Pakistan was enhanced with a Caribou detachment in Kashmir. Four Iroquois helicopters were in Ismailia, Egypt, as part of the UN Emergency Force, or UNEF, and also known as UNEF 2, to observe the ceasefire between Egypt and Israel from July 1976 to October 1979. RAF Iroquois helicopters operated with New Zealand Iroquois between 1982 and 1986 as part of the Multinational Force and Observers, or MFO, under Operation Mazurka, monitoring the Sinai. The Commonwealth Monitoring Force Rhodesia, also known as Operation Damon, or by its Commonwealth name Agila, supported a national referendum on independence for Zimbabwe from the 28th of December 1979 to the 20th of March 1980. This latter operation was technically not a UN mission, but it acted a lot like one. Australia also contributed approximately a dozen peacekeepers to the United Nations True Supervision Organization, under the ADF name Operation Paladin, the United Nations Disengagement Observer Force to oversee the various Arab-Israeli war ceasefires, and 20 personnel were committed to the Commonwealth Military Training Team Uganda to train the Ugandan Army after the overthrow of Idi Amin Dada in March 1982 through to 84. Again, that was not a UN operation, but acted a lot like it and supported peacekeeping. As noted by the Chief of Air Staff, Sir Neville McNamara, Australia considered these commitments, and there were quite a few of them there, were a meaningful contribution for a middle power like Australia to make in supporting global peace, and it also enhanced cooperation with like-minded militaries. In the background of most of those UN commitments stood the old Herky Bird. The UNEF 2 operation in Ismailia was a hive of activity and was an exemplar of how C-130s supported UN missions. UNEF 2 consisted of rotations of about 50 people over many years, and their achievements included carrying over 20,000 passengers, 200 tons of freight, flying about 10,000 operational sorties, and of course I'm referring to all the Iroquois missions and operations, and they also did about 47 AMEs. This pace of activity required regular resupply, troop rotations, and helicopter changeouts to service the aircraft and balance usage rates across the helicopter fleet. Most resupply missions were flown on a six-weekly schedule by C-130s, and they were a key feature for the personnel located in those far-flung locations because it helped break up their busy operational tempo with a sense of connection to home. The same could be said of the MFO detachment at Elgora, which was resupplied by C-130Es every 2 months throughout that detachment's existence. Those regular HERC resupply flights were looked forward to by the C-130 crews because they represented a chance to experience India and the Middle East while gaining proficiency in their long-range flying skills. The UNEF-2 resupply route took crews through Butterworth, Bombay, Bahrain, and that ended in 1979. And then the MFO resupply route was typically via Singapore, Mali, Bahrain, or Pierce, Cocos, Diego Garcia, Bahrain, with regular C-130 flights ending in March 86. Let's talk about one particular mission that came on the back of one of those Middle East taskings. While Australia was engaged in Middle East peacekeeping, another part of the Middle East was in turmoil, as is often the case. In 1977, Iran's Western-leaning secular Shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, began a series of policy changes that alienated domestic Iranian anti-West pro-Islamic forces led by the Ayatollah Khomeini. Heavily influenced by Khomeini from his exile in Iraq and then France, the Iranian revolutionary movement gained so much momentum that by late 1978, Pahlavi was unable to stem the tide of change. In late December, Pahlavi appointed a prime minister to oversee Iran's government and a future referendum, while Pahlavi and his family planned to go overseas on a holiday. It was obvious to everybody that Iran's government would change if Pahlavi left Iran, thereby causing alarm for Westerners in Iran, including Australian civilians. Three 37 Squadron C-130Es and fully augmented crews were put on standby to react to the deteriorating situation, and that was under the name Operation Alecto. But these aircraft were not able to respond when matters took a turn for the worse. It was fortuitous that A-97-190 was programmed for a UNIF resupply mission in early January 79. In Bahrain, on its return leg on the 3rd of January, the aircraft captain, Flight Lieutenant John Rudy Gosper, was advised his crew were on standby for a new mission. His co-pilot, by the way, was Flight Lieutenant Dennis Deej Green, who later became CO 36 Squadron and ended up retiring as an Air Commodore. The crew were told of the possibility of conducting a non-combatant evacuation operation, or a NEO for short, so they unloaded the cargo that they had and rigged the aircraft for passengers. Doctrinally, by the way, a NEO is described as a mission in support of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, whereby non-combatants, so Australians and approved foreign nationals, are evacuated from foreign countries where their lives are endangered by war, civil unrest, or a natural disaster. These missions were described in a few ways, depending on the potential opposition to the operation and the risk to both the evacuees and the military units conducting the NEO. A permissive NEO referred to a situation where the host nation was supportive of the operation. An uncertain NEO meant that the host nation's intentions were uncertain or there was a threat. A hostile NEO involved situations where the operation was likely to be contested by a hostile force. On the 6th of January, the crew was briefed that there was some uncertainty about the situation, but Tehran was expected to be safe enough to conduct the NEO. In other words, the crew was heading into an uncertain operation. Off they went, with RAF nurse squadron leader Rita Blackstock as an additional crew member, just in case. She was a passenger on the Ismailia to Australia flight, and for the flight to Tehran, she didn't wear her uniform, and she wore a full-length dress, head covering, and no makeup just to meet cultural expectations. Iranian airspace was uncontrolled, so the crew used visual procedures to land in Tehran, where they watched tanks tracking the aircraft with their guns while they taxied into parking. The aircraft captain and flight engineer remained in the cockpit in case they needed to restart quickly, and Dennis Green made his way to the crew entrance door. And that was as far as he got, because a rifle barrel was stuck into his chest at the door, and he was told to get back inside the aircraft. Armed Iranian soldiers confined the crew to the aircraft and searched it. With help from the Australian consulate staff, the soldiers permitted the loading of 33 passengers, consisting of Australian, Kiwi, and Canadian citizens. The passengers were mostly embassy staff and their families. They had little luggage with them due to having departed quickly, and they were glad to be escaping the chaotic and increasingly lawless conditions in Tehran. But within minutes of departure, the crew were negotiating with Bahrain Air Traffic Control because Bahrain didn't have their flight details. And of course, being identified as an unknown aircraft in the Middle East is not an ideal situation. For example, the Iranians had F-14 fighters and the Persian Gulf was a tense area. And we might remember that the USS Vincennes accidentally shot down an Iranian civilian airliner flying over Iranian territory in 1988 because of misidentification. But the crew managed, after a few minutes, to sort it all out, and they convinced Bahrain to clear them for the flights, and the rest of the trip was uneventful. Given the threats, this mission was later identified as unique enough that each crew member was awarded an Australian Service Medal with the Special Operations Clasp. After that C-130 non-combatant evacuation operation, Pahlavi departed for his holiday on the 16th of January, and 2 weeks later, on the 1st of Feb, the Ayatollah Khomeini arrived in Iran. Anti-Western sentiment skyrocketed, and Australia decided to divert the next resupply flight in the same manner as John Gosper's was. On the 7th of February, Flight Lieutenant Frank Martin departed Richmond in A97-178 and flew an identical operation to evacuate the remaining Australian embassy staff from Tehran. This mission was a bit more uncertain than the first one, and certainly no less tense. The crew was met by 15 armed soldiers of the People's Militia of the Revolutionary Government of Iran, who boarded the aircraft. After looking behind seats, under boxes, around aircraft internal ducting, etc., etc., they confiscated camera film and permitted the passengers to arrive. First came the luggage, which the crew, including RAF Doctor Group Captain Reed, promptly started packing away behind seats, on the ramp, and in every spare crevice because they were expecting a really full load. Then the passengers arrived, 30 Australians, 17 Canadians, 16 Kiwis, 6 Brits, 3 Europeans, and 1 American, and that included children, one of them being a baby. The tense passengers strapped in their shoulder-to-shoulder seats, hoping for an expeditious departure. The crew noted some anxiety, apprehension, and doubt in the faces of the people, and as was customary on many passenger flights, the loadmaster made a pre-departure announcement, and sensing all that apprehension, as the engines were roaring to life, he said, "The beer's cold in Bahrain." And that announcement was met with a whole bunch of cheering and clapping, and off they went to Bahrain, and I'm guessing they had a beer. The final chapter of the Tehran evacuation was part of a whirlwind trip that departed Richmond on the 25th of February, flown by Flight Lieutenant Don, the Lockheed legend Stewart, in 177. Their mission was an extended UNIF resupply program to go around the world through Greece, Britain, Canada, and the U.S., and it was diverted to fly Bahrain to evacuate the Australian ambassador, who was Marshall Johnson, and the few remaining staff. And that ended Australia's involvement in NEOs out of Tehran. There was one other mission that had a rare event occur while in the Middle East, and it was on a westbound around-the-world flight in A97-190 that departed Richmond on April the 6th, 1983. It was an uneventful mission until the morning of the 10th of April when the aircraft captain, Flight Lieutenant Alan Edwards, received a call from someone at Abu Dhabi Airport. He was advised that his aircraft had moved during the evening, and later that morning, the crew went out to have a look at the airplane, and indeed, they discovered that it had been dragged about 6 meters, and the culprit was a freak gust of about 75 knots. It did a lot of damage, and it required 12 technicians to come out and repair the right wingtip fairing, the number 4 engine, the number 4 propeller, because 2 of the propeller tips were damaged, and both the right main landing gear tires. Pretty impressive that the wind could drag a Herc around like that. And we'll finish off today's episode with a couple of other unique missions that took place in the 75 to 86 era. And the first one was on the 19th of January, 1978, and on this day, the old Herky Bird ended up being an interceptor. Now, surveillance for border protection was not a typical RAF air mobility task. But there were occasions over the life of the C-130s when being the right platform in the right place turned a Herc into an intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance aircraft. And on the 19th of January, 1978, A-97-168 was in the right place at the right time. It was captained by Flight Lieutenant Robert Flapless Haywood, and the aircraft was on final approach to Darwin from Butterworth with 30 passengers on board when the crew was requested to investigate a mystery light aircraft spotted by Darwin radar entering airspace to the west. As the light aircraft traveled inland, ignoring calls from air traffic control, the C-130E caught up with the twin-engine Aero Commander 680E. 168 pulled up alongside, and Haywood waggled his wings to indicate it should follow the Hercules, which it did, briefly, before turning away. After getting vectors from ATC to find the light aircraft again, the C-130 crew followed the light aircraft as it made false position reports and appeared to be looking for somewhere to land. Thinking they were still being chased by the C-130 and probably pretty low on fuel, the light aircraft pilot, whose name was Donald Tate, and his passenger, Leonard Bartley, crash-landed in a field near Catherine at nightfall and set the aircraft on fire to destroy the $4 million worth of high-grade cannabis that they'd smuggled into the country. Thanks to the C-130 chase aircraft, authorities were able to find the aircraft wreckage 14 kilometers northwest of Catherine. Tate was found after he'd spent about 40 hours hiding in the bush, and he spent 7 years in jail. Another strange request for Herx came along in late February 81, when Qantas union workers went on a full strike to protest their long-running complaints about the use of management in union jobs, particularly for the newly acquired 747s. The strikers stopped all international flights from operating, and the strike lasted 21 days. Now, for those of you thinking that this is the big airline strike, no, it's not. It was a small one, and it's a precursor to what was later called Operation Immune, and we're going to talk about that in a separate episode. And this one, as I said, was only 21 days long, and it ended on the 10th of March. During that time, with passengers stranded on both sides of the Tasman Sea for days on end, the Australian and New Zealand governments decided to act. Supporting the Qantas position rather than the union's position, and this was a warm-up for the much bigger one in 1989, the RAF and the RNZAF were tasked to move the stranded passengers, and they unfittingly called it Operation Anzac. I think it was a bit of a misfire naming an operation that supported a commercial interest as Operation Anzac. Anyway, although unions threatened to halt fuel deliveries to the C-130s, from the 1st to the 3rd of March, Herx from both 36 and 37 squadrons flew approximately 3,300 civilian passengers between New Zealand and Australia. And on the busiest day, 14 RAF C-130s were tasked, and by the end of the operation, a total of 70 Australian and Kiwi Herc passenger flights had been flown. That was a major commitment. The use of C-130s to move civilian passengers was welcomed by the Australian population, and that probably influenced the situation in 1989 when they were again committed to moving civilian airline passengers over an extended period. Of course, that's all on the back of the situation in the 1980s when air travel was becoming more and more popular. And that was evidenced by the fact that scheduled service flights were seeing huge numbers of passengers coming on board. And they were so popular in the 1980s that by mid-1982, 86-wing policy required two loadmasters for all service flights. And at the time, Richmond became the fourth busiest regional airport in Australia, with approximately 65,000 passenger movements a year in the early 1980s. Can you imagine? Well, that's a wrap for today. If you know anyone that enjoys military history, aviation, or had some connection to C-130s, please tell them about this podcast. And thank you for listening.